Members, we're going to get started. There's no tremendous pressure because we're not going to be voting on bills. Obviously, we're not in formal legislative session yet, but I do want to maximize our time to have some good discussion around several policy areas that have been of importance that this committee prioritized and put in motion, some work during the interim. I'm looking forward to making us the beneficiaries of great wisdom that's coming forward from the task forces, and then for us to have a conversation about how any of that would inform what we'll be doing in the next several weeks. I want to thank all the members who are here. I know some of you have driven a distance, and I understand there's a blizzard supposedly going to happen somewhere in Minnesota. I was surprised this morning that didn't see a single snowflake falling, but things can change pretty rapidly in Minnesota, as you all know. So I just want to acknowledge members who are coming in from outside the Twin Cities to be here today, and so I want to make sure that I'm very respectful of your time. Today's structure is pretty simple. We're going to hear from three task forces of the five, I believe it is, that we had blessed in the last legislative session, and we're going to organize those task forces around two big areas, and then we'll structure the time together accordingly. So the first big area, the chair is titling Student Accountability, and under that we're going to hear from the Standard Adult High School Diploma Task Force, as well as from the Career Pathways and Technical Education Task Force, and I'll try to monitor our time to make sure that we've got good equal time to have conversation with both of those task force individuals, as well as with the issues that they bring forward. And then the second area, so that'll be student accountability. The second area I'm titling a teacher accountability, and that's where we're going to hear from the Teacher Licensure Advisory Task Force. And members, of course, this has to do first and foremost with the MPLE and how we all struggled with what to do with that particular instrument. And then, frankly, it also has to do with how do we ensure high-quality, effective professionals in the teaching profession early in their career and not just later on. Part of the discussion will also, under both of those, will be for us to dust off, if you will, some of the bills that have been introduced. You all have, over the last year, been thinking about these issues and have introduced bills, and so I don't want to make any assumptions that this committee has already decided on which approach or what bill is the bill. I think it's really important for us, especially in the interim, when we don't have the pressure to vote for a bill, to just look at everything that members have put on the table, and then have a brief discussion around the philosophy and the way those particular approaches, have been designed. Some of the authors of the bill are here, and so that would be a good opportunity for authors of those bills to talk a little bit about their bill. Some of the authors of other bills are not here, so we will be turning to House staff to give us just a brief review of those bills. So that's how I want to proceed today. I can't take any formal action, right? There's no adoption there. Yeah, okay, very good. All right, thank you. All right, so why don't we get going? And we're going to start with, under the Part A part, Student Accountability, we're going to start with the Standard Adult High School Diploma Task Force. And I believe, Mr. Tom, I'm sorry, let me just stop. Are there any questions or advice to the chair or anything that members want to say before we get going? All right. Well, thank you. So let's go forward. So under the Student Accountability, we're going to start with the Standard Adult High School Diploma Task Force. We're going to hear from Tom Citrin Heisem, from Karen Walters, and I believe from an MD staff member as well. So, good morning.
Morning.
Good to see you both. Welcome to the committee. You know the drill. Start by telling us who you are, and then let's hear your description of your work. Why, in your opinion, that was important for this task force to have been created? What were the issues before you? You know, just sort of warm us up to remind us, you know, what was here, and then let's move on to your recommendations, and then we'll open it up for some discussion.
My name is Tom Citrin-Heisem. I'm the legislative chair for the Literacy Action Network, which is a statewide professional organization for adult basic education. And I will give a very brief overview of the context of where this came from. And then Karen Walters will introduce herself, will report from the task force.
And my name is Karen Walters, and I'm the chair of the Standard Adult Diploma Task Force.
Good morning.
Mr. Chair, committee members, just to refresh your memory, about 2.5 to 3 years ago, Literacy Action Network worked with the Adult Basic Education Office at the Department of Education to begin exploring options for some alternative secondary credentials. The only statewide option has been the GED up till now, which does not meet the needs of all learners. Some individual districts have offered an adult diploma for people 21 and older. The standards have been inconsistent, and there has been no statewide norm. So we had an initial task force that met for over a year, working with a consultant, doing a thorough review of what was going on in other states, many of whom have adopted some sort of alternative secondary credential path. Last year, legislation was introduced based on that report and passed by the legislature, authorizing the creation of a Minnesota adult diploma. Part of that legislation was the initiation of a second task force, which was to work on developing the standards that would and the competencies that would be integrated into this new credential. And with that, I will pass the torch to Karen to give us a report on the task force.
Very well. Thank you. Ms. Walters.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Karen Walters, and I have worked in the adult basic education field for 20 years, and I would like to thank you for the opportunity to represent this task force today that you created last year. Just a brief update on who was on our task force. We had one representative from the MNSCU, Minnesota State Colleges and Universities System, one person from the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, one person from the Department of Employment and Economic Development, one representative from the Minnesota Department of Education, and five adult basic education practitioners. We met from August through January, and we met seven times. We researched the current standards that exist statewide and nationwide with adult basic ed and K-12. And we looked at the different national models that exist in about five different states in depth. And today I'm going to share with you some information that we learned. First, I'd like to give you a little bit of background about the numbers of people who need a GED or a high school diploma in our state and nationwide. According to the 2012 American Community Survey's five-year estimates, there are 286,000 Minnesotans who do not have a high school credential at this time. The GED testing service estimates that 3,500 people drop out of high school nationwide every year. The adult basic education system in Minnesota serves these students. The adult basic education system is currently housed through the Department of Education. And last year, we served 75,000 people across the state of Minnesota. 5,600 of them earned a GED last year, and 218 of those adults earned an adult diploma. Like Tom mentioned, we do not have consistent adult diploma programming throughout the state. The GED is the one thing that's consistent. There are two options right now for people who need to earn a diploma as an adult learner. The first one is a standardized test called the GED. The second one is, if you have access through your district, you may be able to complete the credits that you have left and finish off a high school diploma as an adult. That option right now is not statewide. It's not consistent. The GED test is a standardized test. It's a timed test. There recently have been significant changes to that test. In the past, it was a paper-based test, so the local ABE consortia could be a testing center and provide testing to people across the state. At the end of 2013, the test changed, and the GED testing service contracted with Pearson View, which is a computer-based for-profit company, and they now proctor the test. Pearson View charges more money. It now costs $120 to take the GED as opposed to $80 in the past. And there's fewer testing centers across the state. At this time in northern Minnesota, people need to drive over 200 miles to access a testing center. It is more difficult to set up a testing center because of the computerized nature of that. And so ABE programs aren't as easily able to become Pearson View testing centers. So access and cost are issues with the GED right now. The credit completion option works for those who are very close to finishing high school, but it doesn't work for people who dropped out in maybe 9th grade or 10th grade and have full-time years worth of credits to earn. It takes too long for them to finish that way, and they don't usually finish that way. So our committee looked at creating a third option. This is very different from a standardized test or a credit-based system. This will be a competency-based diploma for those that are no longer eligible for K-12. Our task force came up with 13 recommendations for you, and I'd just like to briefly go through those recommendations. You have a report that gives you the details of these. I'll kind of clump them into chunks.
And members, members, those should be in your packet.
Right.
So you might want to follow those along as Ms. Walters goes through the recommendations.
I would be starting on
page 7, it looks like.
Page 7. The first recommendation that we're making today is to institute a statute change rather than going through the rulemaking process. Last year when this came through the legislature, we found out that they had recommended rulemaking at that time, and our task force would prefer to have a statute change for a couple of reasons. The first reason is that rulemaking is costly to the department, and it will take significant time to go through that process. It could take up to a year and a half to go through that process, and that delays the ability for people to be working on their high school diploma. The second one is that in July of 2012, when the federal law changed regarding federal financial aid, we no longer can have any of our students access financial aid unless they have a high school diploma or a GED in play in hand. And so it hinders them from moving forward with their educational and training goals if they can't get financial aid. So if we can move through statute change, it would help our learners get moving sooner. Recommendations 2, 3, and 4 refer to the process for establishing adult diploma programs and the accountability around that. So recommendation 2, what we'd like to do is suggest that Minnesota Department of Education come up with an approval process where they establish requirements and process for an application where adult basic education programs can apply to be a diploma granting entity. And then recommendation 3 would be that ABE consortia across the state would be able to apply to the Department of Ed and get approved to be a diploma granting entity. There are currently 46 adult basic education consortia across Minnesota, and every school district is part of a consortium, of an ABE consortium. So every school district could be served by their local ABE consortium if they choose to apply to be a diploma site. Our ABE system has an accountability measure in place where every 5 years we go through an intensive 5-year narrative process where we write to the Department of Ed, Adult Basic Ed, and we renew our programs. So that's our accountability measure there for every 5 years. And we would anticipate that those who get approved as diploma-granting entities would be renewed every 5 years through that process. Recommendation 5 stems from a best practice that we learned when we were researching all the diploma programs throughout the nation. And so recommendation 5 is that every adult basic ed program that is approved to have a diploma program would have individual advising for their students. This aligns well with the world's best workforce legislation that's already in place. This advising would include identifying learning goals, assessing individual skills and experience, identifying a student's career pathway, their employment and educational goals, identifying their instructional needs, and then creating an individual learning plan for each student. This individual learning plan, like the world's best workforce, would be a document and a process that they would work through while they're in the adult basic education program completing that diploma. And the experiences that they have in school and out of school would align with their career preferences. The ongoing advising would take place while they're in the program, and they would have a plan set for them when they leave to pursue their career pathway. I'm going to move on to recommendation 6, and this is about the standard requirements that would be set forth. So we would like to see rigorous and consistent standards throughout the state. This is important because we want to have every ABE program having the same set of consistent standards. They would align with the K-12 academic standards that are pertinent to the adult learner. The areas we've identified for standards would be language arts, including reading, writing, listening, and speaking, mathematics, social studies, and science. In addition to those four academic areas, we see a couple of other areas, including career development and employability skills. And those two competencies are critical to adult learners who need to work and move forward with a career pathway. Recommendation number 7 refers to the assessment of those areas. As you all know, as adults, you have a lot of experiences, you have a lot of a wealth of knowledge that you bring to the table that a 17-year-old or 18-year-old high school student would not yet have. So we would like to see a variety of ways for adults to demonstrate the competency of those standards. One way would be to honor their prior experience. And this could include things like a K-12 course they've already taken, post-secondary courses they may have taken, some ABE instruction that they've already done. A second way would be test-verified knowledge. So if a student had taken an ACCUPLACER exam, which is a college placement test, and passed it at college ready, they maybe wouldn't need to take that particular area of competency because they're already testing ready. And we could come up with a variety of tests, timed and untimed, that would work to satisfy competency in specific areas. We also came up with ABE instruction and course completion. You may or may not know that adult basic education has a wealth of courses, career pathway programming, fast track programming, college preparation programming that could be used, that's already in place, that could be used to demonstrate competency. The fourth way would be applied and experiential learning through contextualized projects. Applied learning is very important for an adult learner. Experiential learning is very important for an adult learner. They may participate in volunteer experiences, internships, or other contextualized projects that are relevant to their lives. Recommendations 8, 9, and 10 talk about the portability and transferability of this initiative. We would like to see standards set across the state that refers to the portability so that people will not be restarting every time they join a new program. Transferability refers to a common transcript that all ABE programs would use. So when someone leaves a program and the student requests their transcript, ABE programs all know how to interpret that transcript and can easily determine what has been completed, what partial standards have been completed. The diploma granting piece, at this time, the Minnesota Department of Education would be asked to grant the diploma as a standard. That's how it would be set up. If a local district would like to grant a diploma, they would have that option to be a diploma granting district. And in the state of Wisconsin, when we did our research, the state of Wisconsin grants diplomas, but in most cases, the local districts want to grant it from the local district as well. So although the state provides the option, it seems like the local areas would like to be able to grant a diploma. In my experience in working with learners for 20 years in a diploma program, they usually want a local diploma if they can get that. Recommendations 11, 12, and 13 refer to how the programs will be operationalized. We would recommend that an advisory committee be set up through the Department of Education that would provide guidance on policies and would be able to review the local programs and the applications and develop accountability measures. And that would be a long-term ongoing group. Then we would also have a shorter-term ABE working group, and that group has already met once. And that would be to develop, you know, the specific standard requirements, the processes, what that advising would look like, and keep it operational and consistent throughout the state. There would be, we'd like to see a department assistance through the Minnesota ABE at the Minnesota Department of Education. So that they can help programs develop, implement, and evaluate their programming. And we've been assured through the Department of Ed, ABE office, that they already have staff and capacity in place to do that. My involvement in this task force and experience in ABE have brought me to a conclusion that I'd like to share with you. We all must consider the future of our economy in Minnesota. In 5 to 8 years, the baby boomers will retire. The employers will be in need of qualified workers. They probably already are. And we're facing a skills gap in our current workforce, as you all know. There aren't going to be enough people in K-12 who are going to graduate to fill those jobs. And we cannot afford to leave anyone behind, especially our adult learners and our current workers. We need to provide options for them to complete high school so that they can meet their educational and training goals and fulfill those jobs. This competency-based diploma option will allow the adults to demonstrate their skills and knowledge that a standardized exam like the GED cannot measure. It will provide free access to those who cannot afford a GED, and it will help people who cannot drive to and find a testing center at this time. It's critical to move this forward now for the individual's prosperity and society as a whole. And I thank you for your time today. I would love to answer questions that you have about the initiative.
Thank you, Ms. Walters, Mr. Citron Heisen. I have a couple of questions, and then I want to invite members to join in. First of all, let me just say I do want to acknowledge and perhaps reemphasize your last point about the vital importance of being able to create an effective pathway for the about 300,000 on a yearly basis of Minnesota adults over 25 years of age who still do not possess a high school diploma. And I don't think that when we think of our state, we think of our state as being a place where that many folks, currently don't have that, what many of us consider pretty basic nowadays, accreditation necessary for success and for being able to contribute effectively to the well-being of our state. So it's just, I do want to reemphasize the importance of the work here. And obviously, with the task force, has come to is a conclusion that we've got ways in which we can provide access and opportunities for individuals to do that, to achieve that basic level of accreditation in our state, but that isn't enough. And so you're proposing, I think, a very creative but responsible third pathway to be able to complement that. And so I just want to acknowledge that up front and thank you for the what must have been some very you know, deep dives into how can we best serve this group of people that just are not going to fill, you know, being able to take advantage of what we currently have. I just have a couple very quick questions. I have a ton of questions, but I really want the other members to jump in. First of all, and they're kind of small questions, actually. You said at the very beginning that of the two existing options, the one in terms of credit recovery and, you know, interacting with your local school district, many are not able to complete it because of access issues. And I take it when you meant access issues, it has to do with they're simply not eligible by age to be able to be covered under our K-12 formula appropriations. But are there other access issues as well that that arise?
Mr. Chair, what I was referring to was you were correct in that once people reach the age of 21, local high schools can no longer get funding for them through the.
Okay, all right.
But also, adult basic education programs many of them do not have adult diploma programming available. So there are, I know of maybe a handful of programs throughout the state that have adult diploma programming available. They just don't have it. And the ones that have it and offer it don't necessarily have consistent standards. So.
And so that probably speaks to kind of the complexity, if you will, and resource issues to be able to provide
exactly.
that. And I'm kind of guessing that we're talking about small communities around the state, perhaps, or not.
Mr. Chair, committee members,
yes, Mr.
small communities, but also I can speak for St. Paul, having worked with their consortium for quite a while, and quite a number of years ago, they needed to discontinue their adult diploma program because it was basically it was a credit recovery type program trying to do that within basically having a high school within the context of an adult basic ed program. As you know, the funding formula for ABE is much less than for K-12, and there simply were inadequate resources to maintain that particular effort. And I think that's true of many programs around the state.
And frankly, we haven't done ABE a favor in the last couple of years as we struggle with our state budget. And I note, members, that you know we've made our schools whole now relative to the borrowing, but we haven't made ABE whole in this regard, because that was part of the mix of things that we tragically felt that we needed to do to have a balanced budget. And so there's an unfinished business there. But that's another topic. You said something, Ms. Walters, about GED and financial aid. And I just want to be real clear, because I thought what I heard is not what I thought I heard before. What is the status in terms of access to post-secondary financial aid relative to having a GED from here going forward?
Okay. In July of 2012, a federal law was passed that students must have a high school diploma or a GED to access federal financial aid. Prior to July of 2012, students who did not have a high school diploma or a GED who wanted to go to college could go to a local college, a community college, for example, in Mankato, this happened quite often, and they could take a placement exam. And if they placed at a certain level where it was determined that they had the ability to benefit from college, they would still be able to get financial aid. Now, that testing, the ability to benefit is gone, and you have to have a diploma or a GED to access federal financial aid.
Okay, good. Thank you for the clarification. And so obviously, you know, what we're trying to do when you back up to the world's best workforce framework and some of the other work that we did, is this legislature is trying to really focus on how do we maximize career and post-secondary educational opportunities, understanding that those are pretty basic now, experiences in order to have, you know, healthy communities, a healthy economy, healthy individuals. And so I get it. I think that it seems like the federal move is a good move insofar as, you know, both the adult diploma and GED are necessary indicators of success, you know, for those post-secondary career opportunities. But given some of the challenges that you shared with us in terms of access, programs around the state, we're running the risk of leaving a lot of people behind in terms of not being able to access financial aid. I'm going to stop there. I have a lot of other questions. I know the department is here, and I want the department at some point to come down and talk to us briefly about capacity issues. There's a number of recommendations here that beg a question about capacity at the Department of Education, and so I want them to think about that and come down and give us some thoughts. But at this point, let me ask, let me open up for members to weigh in here. Representative Russo, and then Representative Aronson Sandra. Representative Russo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had some constituents talking to me last year who were all immigrants. Some of them were refugees. And so my question has to do with that group of people. How would this program help in the case of people who've had their schooling interrupted, maybe lack their transcripts? School systems can be different. And in particular, one of their concerns was that they may have already done math and science and geography and things like that, but are hampered by their level of academic English skills if they have to do it by test. And the programs that were available to them, they were being forced to start over at the beginning because they didn't have credits that could transfer. So would this help that group?
Ms. Walton.
Representative, we have in Mankato addressed that issue for many, many years. And this program would certainly help that population. In my experience, the ESL population has a lot to offer, a lot of experiences and a lot of knowledge, and the language is the barrier for them. So this would allow them to capture the knowledge they have in a portfolio and allow them to develop those skills that they still need to be effective at work. We actually created a competency-based diploma program for our ESL learners in Mankato because of that issue, and it's been very successful for several years. So I think my take on that is this would really, that's one population that this would really help, because they have a very difficult time passing a standardized test in the time limit that they're given.
Representative Russo?
That's all. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your presentation and your good work on the advisory task force. Having served on one, I know how much work it is, and your report is so concise, so thank you very much to all who served on that task force. My question is about the test that's going to be used and the fact that you mentioned standards need to be aligned with our K-12 standards. And what I've heard is that this test is based on Common Core. So would you comment on whether or not that's what the Pearson view does, or is there something else in the works?
Ms. Walters.
Representative, I'm a little confused about the test. Are you talking about the GED exam?
Yes, I'm sorry. Yes,
okay.
The GED.
And you want to know more information about what that's going to be like, or yes, what that is like now as compared to what it was like?
Yes, what is it going to be now? Thank
okay.
you, Mr. Chair.
And Ms. Walters, I just want to be real clear also. So you're about to answer, it sounds like, based on the new GED.
Mm-hmm.
But I just want to be real clear. The recommendation is about a third pathway.
Correct.
Is not about a GED. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative. The what we envision happening is that the GED will be one way that'll continue, and that will be always be in place for students to do. This third pathway is different from the GED. However, they could take one of the GED exams, one piece like the reading part, the reading through language arts, that could be taken to satisfy one piece of competency in the diploma if necessary. If a student had, for example, a math disability and could never do a standardized test in the time allowed, they may choose to do some parts of the GED and then take a class and demonstrate their competency for the math. The difference between the old GED, the 2002 version, and the 2014 version is that now, yes, that new 2014 version is aligned with Common Core, and it is computer-based.
Mm-hmm.
The old version was there were five parts to the test, and now there are four. It is a little more rigorous than it was before, but the access issues are the main issues we see in Minnesota right now. One thing that we know about the GED and about the employers in our state is that a standardized test such as the GED does not tell the employers everything they need to know about a student. And so this diploma would be more than just standardized testing. The students would actually be able to demonstrate all of the prior experiences and knowledge that they have and the skills that they have that a standardized test cannot measure or show. And so employers would be able to know if a person is showing up, following through, can give a presentation, all of those essential skills that are you know important to the workforce, rather than just knowing that they can pass a standardized test in a certain amount of time. Does that answer your question,
Mr. Chair?
Representative Ertz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And yes, to a certain extent. But isn't this going to require more paperwork on the part of your staff or the staffs in these locations? Because if you have a test taken to verify competency, and then they're also working on the other pieces that are optional to fulfill, it seems to me that you're going to have a bit of a good organization for that student to know what's being accomplished and when, and then be able to report that out.
Ms. Walters.
Representative, yes, that is true. It will take some effort on our part to keep track of everyone's portfolio. We imagine an online portfolio where the student would be able to access and add things to it from anywhere, and teachers would be able to access that and assess it from anywhere. In Mankato, we've talked about how we would operationalize that, and we imagine our GED staff working as adult diploma staff as well. So we would have people coming in for GED classes, but they also would be working on projects towards an adult diploma, and teachers would become a high school completion teacher rather than just a GED instructor. So it's because we're going to be accessing the programming that's already in place and connecting them to the resources that are already in place to demonstrate those competencies, we don't see it being overwhelming for the system to absorb.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you very much, Ms. Walters.
Thank
that
you.
Was very interesting.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Representative Ertz. And actually, on that point, and we don't need to do a deep, but has the recommendations of the task force been shared with groups like Minnesota School Boards Association, school administrators, et cetera? In other words, folks whose duties have to do partly with, you know, tending to the infrastructural ability of schools to be able to competently play a role in this. Have you had an opportunity yet to have those conversations?
Mr. Chair, representatives, at this time, I know that we have shared the information. I've personally shared the information with our ABE system at large. And I would like to call on Brad Haskamp from the Department of Ed to talk about if any other entities have been contacted and talked to, because I'm not sure about that.
Okay. Why don't we bring Brad down? And Brad, no need to do that right away, because I do have a couple of other questions from members. And we'll certainly circle back to that. And that gives you a little time to think about the answers. Representative Barrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Walters, I just have a question about trying to understand the type of person who would take advantage of this opportunity. Mm-hmm. It looks like on page three, there's 285,000 people who age 25 or older who don't have a high school diploma. I don't know if there's a breakdown between how many of those folks are close to getting a diploma or not, or how many have ever went to high school or school in Minnesota. But I'm trying to understand the person who would take advantage of it. Are these folks who are close to getting a high school education? And then if true, take me through the process of how, what they would have to do when they decide they want the adult equivalent diploma. What would they have to do? How long would it take? Okay. What's the workload involved, the time requirement from their perspective? Let's say they have a year left in their high school education.
Ms. Walsh.
Representative, I'm just going to share a story with you about a gentleman that I think would have probably been a good candidate. He's already done now, but there was a man who came to us last year. His name was George, and he had 5 children, was laid off from his job, and he was married and had significant test anxiety. He had been working. He was must have been 45 or 50 years old. He had been working for many, many years, never earned his high school diploma. And when he came to us, he had a lot of anxiety about going back to school. He knew he needed to, and he knew he needed to upskill. He came in, and it took us some time just to get him to be able to, you know, take a test and be in the classroom. He eventually did pass the old version of the GED, the 2002 version, and he barely passed. He just got the minimum scores that he needed to move forward. And we recommended to him that he spend some time in our college prep program before he move into the local community college because we were concerned about his skill level. He was willing to spend the time with us and work on it. He was with us for at least 4 or 5 months. But when he moved into college, he took a heating, venting, and air conditioning certificate program. It's a 1-year program, and it doesn't require a liberal arts education, so he didn't need to meet the AccuPlace replacement scores. And his minimum GED scores were enough for him to get into that. And he came in with his report card just the other day, and his first semester he was straight A's, like 2 B's and all A's. And his confidence level was just amazing because he now was moving forward and he wasn't stuck where he was at. He knew that he could do it. So I imagine students who have a significant amount of high school left and a credit-based thing would not be feasible for them to stick around for a year or two to complete. I imagine a person like George who wants to move forward, needs to move forward, probably is not ready to pass a computerized test. His computer skills were questionable. He's at the minimum level. He probably wouldn't maybe today be able to pass that GED math. But he's certainly ready to move forward in the workforce, has a really good work history, and he's ready to move forward and kind of knows what he wants. And he'll now, in this year, finish a certificate program at the college that will get him a decent job, where in the past he would have had to sit in high school and finish all the credits or work on that GED for more than a year to be able to pass it. And he'll be employable much sooner. So I see students who are, in my experience, students who are a little older, who have a lot to offer, have a lot of experience to share, could demonstrate easily some of the competencies without having to take a lot of instruction, but still will need some instructional work and will need to get connected to a career pathway. So I look at it as a way for people to move forward right now on what they can tackle. The states that we researched that were competency-based indicated that depending on their experience, some students could move through the diploma in 3 to 9 months rather than spending years taking all of the credits they needed to take. And it would really depend on their time, how much time they're willing to commit, what kinds of experiences they already have. So that's the first part of your answer. Does that help you to understand the population I'm thinking of?
Representative Barrett.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it does a little bit. I think what you're saying is it's dependent on the individual, how much experience they have, and how much of that experience would qualify for their rigorous academia that they would be not having to do. So, I mean, it depends. We haven't written the rules yet. Obviously, the law hasn't been passed. So I don't know if there is an answer. Just trying to get an understanding for the time frame involved, how rigorous, and right, whether they could easily pass it and whether they should easily pass it, whether there's some amount of time and commitment to doing something that other folks take 12, 13 years to do.
Right. Representative, would you like me to tell you about the process that I know? You just mentioned what would it look like, or do you not
want? No, I'm good. Thank you. I don't want to monopolize the time here. I know we don't have too much time today. We have a lot of workload, so we can okay. address that at another time. Thank you.
Thank
Appreciate
you.
It.
Thank you, Representative. Obviously, we'll be continuing this conversation and in the context of moving some bills during the session. I do want to ask the department folks to come down. There's two kind of two questions. One was the question that Representative Erickson and I triggered about. So, you know, who have we connected to in terms of capacity issues of the K-12 delivery system? And then there's the my question at the very beginning about capacity issues at the Department of Ed and what the department spokespeople can tell us relative to their assuming for a second that these recommendations were all implemented. You know, what's the department's capacity outlook in terms of fulfilling the work here? Morning, gentlemen.
Thank you, Chair, committee members. My name is Brad Haskamp with the Minnesota Department of Education.
I'm Darren Cordier, Government Relations Director with the Minnesota Department of Education.
And in terms of, in speaking towards the capacity of the department, in implementing the adult diploma proposal, if it were to be passed, the department does have the capacity to implement the recommendations from the report. We have an ABE state office that has staff hired and utilizes a combination of state and federal funding for adult basic education purposes, and we could utilize that staffing and our capacity and our roles to build this option. In addition, working with local programs, we would be able to utilize special grants with our state funding. We have supplemental service grants, and we would, if this law were to pass, we could allocate a portion of those supplemental service grants to help implement and provide some advisory capacity for the adult diploma option to implement it statewide and to handle a lot of the best document best practices, provide technical assistance, and other leadership activities. In addition, all adult basic education programs in the state do utilize the same database, and we would build additional capacity within that database to incorporate this transcript that the task force recommends and other pieces to enable and support the work of the adult diploma programming.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members, I would only add that as Ms. Walters testified, there are a number of ABE consortia that were using adult diplomas in the past, and our folks, of course, were assisting them in creating that. So I think that some of this work has already, you know, been done by our folks, so they already kind of know what they're doing in this area, so the learning curve won't be so steep. And also, I think having that advisory council in place to make sure that there's some consistent standards in place for those for that adult diploma program is actually going to work to the benefit of our staff.
So, gentlemen, so it's it sounds like there's the thought in the department about responsibly being able to pursue a frame like this. I'm going to kind of put you on the spot. Is the department going to be coming forward with a recommendation of its own relative to this, or what's the approach of the department in terms of advice to the legislature, given the task force's recommendations?
Mr. Chair, members, I know it's have a unique situation that we're in here often when there are new duties asked of the department. You know, due to kind of our tight budget situation, we don't always have the ability to take on new tasks. This is, as I said, kind of a unique situation where I think that the scope of the work that's being asked under the task force, a lot of it's kind of in the wheelhouse of our staff that are already there. We won't need to hire new staff with new expertise to handle this. You know, there is some funding systems in place in order to cover this, so we would not be bringing forward a further budget request in order to fund the responsibilities that were asked under this task force report.
Very well. Thank you, gentlemen. Members, I want to push ahead. I did, as I said earlier, part of what I want to do today is then also dust off some of those bills, but I want to do that toward the end of our conversation and meeting time together. partly because there's some testifiers that need to get in and out of here relatively soon. And so I'm going to push ahead to the second part of Part A under student accountability, which is the Career Pathways and Technical Education Task Force presentation. And we're joined by Richard Rosevich from Irondale High School. You know, if Rukavino was here, he would just have a blast with that last name. He might even say it's Rosevich. Richard Rosevich from Irondale High School, and then I believe the Assistant Commissioner Rose Hermanson as well. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. I'm here to lend moral support since his co-chair is in Iowa and has taken a new job, so to help answer questions for our one chair that was able to make it today.
Wonderful.
Mr. Chairman, representatives, my name is Richard Rosevich. I'm a National Board Certified Teacher at Irondale High School in New Brighton and co-chair of the Career Pathways and Technical Education Task Force. On behalf of co-chair Dr. Pradeep Kodamandru and the task force members, I wanted to thank you for the opportunity to engage in this very valuable work. I would especially like to recognize and thank two members of your committee for their dedicated work, Representative Erdahl and Representative Breinert. They were both very helpful in guiding the work of the task force. At the outset, I think it's important to acknowledge that there are and have been many good practices underway in Minnesota for several years. We learned about many of these in our task force meetings. First, we heard from a panel of employers about their workforce needs and expectations, and that helped establish a context for understanding where we were trying to go in carrying out the charge of the task force. We also received testimony about current acceleration opportunities, including the early college program at my high school, rigorous course waivers, longitudinal data systems. Task force also had several presentations from DEED and representatives from the Office of Higher Education. We cast a pretty wide net because we had a pretty big charge. And I hope that you appreciate that the recommendations we have are really directed towards trying to give you some sense of how to move forward with that project, understanding that there are going to be some things we think you can do now, and there are some things that we understand will take a few years of sustained effort to carry out. From early on in our work, it became clear, after receiving all that testimony, that one of the key challenges before us was to increase the capacity of our systems to bring the many good practices we saw to scale so that all of our students could benefit from them. The recommendations that you have in the report were adopted unanimously by the task force, and they are our best effort to identify which parts of the existing system need to be enhanced, which need supplementation, and which would benefit most from increased coordination and collaboration among stakeholders. The options for implementation listed with each of the recommendations are suggestions for you to consider as you think about how you might enact the recommendation. They are meant to be illustrative of our thinking process, not prescriptive. While we think that all the recommendations are important, they are not an all or nothing package. Each recommendation is meant to stand on its own, and each will contribute incrementally toward the development of career and college-ready students. Taken together, we believe that the effects will be additive, producing greater results soon.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Rose Hermanson. My job this past summer was to keep your staff busy attending task force meetings, and I think we accomplished that. This is one of five, probably the task force with the largest charge, because you ask us to come up, make recommendations on how to structurally redesign secondary and post-secondary education. And I think we have two committees or four committees at the legislature that are in charge of handling some of the details of both of those systems. The task force took its charge very seriously, but it also found that it is a huge endeavor to think about all the moving parts. In particular, we have statutes that exist that we had to go back and review and look at. particularly the world's best workforce, what's going on there, along with statutes that talk about experiential learning and other parts that were just passed during this past session, and how do they all integrate with what the charge was that the task force had. I'm going to just kind of walk briefly through the recommendations, and Richard can help me with that as well. I'm going to start on page 8 of the report, and the one thing is,
well, members, I'm sorry, that should be in your packet, Career Pathways and Technical Education Advisory Task Force, and as Assistant Commissioner Hermanson just indicated, the walkthrough will begin on page 8 of that report.
Thank you. The task force, the structure of the membership of the task force was set forth in statute. And so the individuals who served on the task force, there were a few that were open appointments, but primarily they were appointed to this task force by organizations or areas that you designated, including DEED and higher ed and membership from within the higher ed institutions. The framework, which was laid out on page 7, kind of was the framework the task force worked around, how to put all of this together. The first recommendation is found on page 8, but it's not listed as recommendation 1 or 2. It was that as we did our work, we found that there is no definition as to what college and career ready means.
It's actually amazing to me, because it's a term that we've both sides of the aisle have been using for a number of years, and we sort of have I think we have a pretty clear thing of what that is, and pretty clear thought in mind, but we haven't committed it to statute yet.
And Mr. Chair, members, we kind of noted that. We did actually go out and do some researches and found that we're not the only state. There's very few states that actually have a definition. And I thought it would, the task force then sat down, reviewed some of that, and we worked off a definition that actually was first proposed by a P20 council about 7-8 years ago and modified that. So this was not the first attempt to bring forward a definition of what do we mean when we talk about career and college ready. We offer that for your consideration. It's on page 8, and I think it's important that as a policy-setting body, the legislature decide what is it you mean when you talk about it. This is a very general one. Some can be more specific, but it is our first recommendation. Let's define what it is that we are talking about. Recommendation number 1 ties into 2 existing statutes, and those 2 existing statutes really call for an individual student career plan. I think as you go through these recommendations, you're going to see 2 or 3 focuses. One is, and it kind of ties on to what the adult diploma is doing, sit down with the individual and figure out what it is we should be doing with that individual student. We've talked about individual student planning a lot in the past. I think this task force feels very strongly that we need to put in place a structure that actually can accomplish that. And the pieces under that career planning are several. One is the district setting goals. It's the parents and the students having access to information, and in particular access to assessment information that gives them a clear picture of what they're capable of doing, what they need to accomplish if they want to go into a certain area, either in post-secondary or as part of a career. And we need these need to be a comprehensive plan and guided by ways that they can make good decisions around it. We have a lot of information about careers out there, either through DEED or through the Department of Ed, but I think the concern of the committee was that we somehow pull this together in a meaningful structure that involves the parents and the students working with schools in getting that plan in place. And I don't know if Richard wants to add anything.
Yeah, and so that in essence covers those first 3 recommendations. The way they're tiered up, the first recommendation says, building on the statutes, we have these plans. And what you heard from the Adult Basic Diploma Task Force was the idea that the plans should be enhanced in terms of the description of the process. So it lays out in very good order what kinds of things should be included in the plan. We make some suggestions about a few other things to add to that, specifically assessment data. But we're also interested in other things that they're interested in terms of making it more portable, in terms of being clearer with school districts about how the process of developing the plan should be done. Recommendation 2 really focuses on providing resources within the school and the community for students to help guide them in that process. And that guidance process, again, was touched on by the Adult Basic Diploma Group, okay, that students need to have, whether they're adult learners or they're K-12 learners, they need to have access to individuals who have reliable information and have the skills to advise them properly about how to take advantage of that. Recommendation 3 focuses on providing resources to families and community members so that they can actively engage with students in the planning process, recognizing the value that families add and bring to that process. And so that's where recommendation 3 comes in.
Mr. Chair, members, Rose Hermanson, all students, everybody kept pointing, put all in front of kids, and I guess we kind of said that's our assumption. You'll see special reference to students with disabilities. We want to stress the importance of students who are struggling more in schools, that it's even more important that they have the advice and counsel and also a structure by which they can gather information to learn what it is they need to know if they're going to go forward and be productive students. The important part here is how we have staff in place to help guide them and work with parents and students. I think whether it's a counselor or whether we train our teaching staff or whether we have others available who have good information, who know how to put that information together in a workable plan for students is really key to this being successful. We've talked about individual student plans for a long time, but making a meaningful and using assessment data, using the information we have and having the information at our fingertips about job choices, about skill sets that are going to be needed, it's going to take some training and some development to have staff in place to work with students, and that includes the teacher in the classroom. How do we integrate this within our teaching experience with kids rather than just set aside a separate class and say, I'm going to take a career class, so therefore now I know what's out there as career. So it's more of an integrated approach that the task force foresaw.
So just to continue with the walkthrough briefly, recommendation 4 does touch on experiential learning, and you heard some about that. That was an area of intense discussion, and it was something that we really feel we need to provide districts with the opportunity to allow students to have more experiential learning. And we recognize that that is a significant challenge in Greater Minnesota. And so we are suggesting within that some fairly broad definitions of what constitutes experiential learning. But I think that that's something, again, that you may want as a policymaking body to consider how you would define that particular term as well and to provide guidance to districts as they choose to implement it. Recommendation 5 talks about how to effectively partner between K-12 and higher education systems to expand opportunities for credit offerings, really, basically. We'll get into some of those things a little bit more, I think.
Right, and this is going to take collaboration across systems. One of the things that became apparent in the task force is there's a tendency to protect turf a little bit, and so if we're going to be allowing programs that allow kids to move at a pace where they're ready, we're going to have a great deal of collaboration among systems and between, and even among districts as well.
Recommendation 6 talks a little bit about some of those structural elements of the teaching staffs that we have. So when Commissioner Hermanson was describing how to provide teaching staffs with the experiences they need to be able to effectively advise students, that's where this structural piece comes in. So it's a systemic look at how we approach our teaching force, both at the secondary level and at the post-secondary level, and trying to get a better understanding of how we utilize the strength of the resources we have at both levels. Recognizing that there, when we talk about, as I mentioned, beginning supplementation, We do recognize that these are areas that we will need to do some additional work in, and so there will be changes. It's not just pushing peas around the plate. We are going to be asking people to do more and to do things differently there.
And members, just a quick observation on the part of the chair, but it's only one member's observation. In a little bit, we're going to be talking about the MTLE issue. And so you begin to see some potential overlaps here, which I think are opportunities for us in terms of how do we continue to evolve a policy frame of expectations of our teaching professional core informed by things that we value. And arguably, what the task force is putting on the table in regards to recommendation 6 and how it connects to the other recommendations is an additional way to value the use of our additional way to think about our professional teaching core based on valuing things like experiential learning, collaboration, guiding students powerfully through a very mature planning process, et cetera.
And Mr. Chair, I would add, it's going to take some rethinking on the part of higher ed as well.
Indeed.
One of the things that came forward as we were looking at some of these professional development and teacher certification or licensure issues, how would you build that into a teacher prep program? And there was some concern expressed about expanding what they would need to do and offering additional coursework. I think our encouragement to them was we probably need to look at ways of building that into your preparation programs that you currently have, the coursework you currently have. If you're going to be emphasizing experiential learning as you train teachers in math or science or whatever, that should be incorporated within the courses currently being operated. So there will be some changes in higher ed as well.
Thank you. Please continue.
Recommendation 7 was about providing flexible governance and operational structures in educational institutions. And essentially, this is the way that I see this is a placeholder that says, please don't stifle innovation. That's really what that to me means, is that we do have these wonderful practices that have been implemented in different places and developed in different places because of the flexibility that we have in the system. So, for example, the early college program at Irondale High School we were able to do that within the existing framework of legislation that we had. And we know that there will be additional models that people will bring forward. And while at the same time we recognize that to achieve the overall goals of college and career readiness, we do need some uniformity, we also don't want to squeeze out opportunities for people to innovate and to come up with new and creative ways of doing this work. And so listed under that, you have some options for implementation that were brought forward that suggest ways that people might choose to go in the future with that.
And Mr. Chair, the final recommendation really is at the agency level. What do we need to do between DEED, which carries a lot of the information about employment trends, in what's going on there, and MDE and other post-secondary institutions. How do we create collaboration across these systems as well as involve our communities in making sure we have complete and accurate information out there about what jobs are available? I was thinking as I drove in is what I was thinking about as an 18-year-old in high school. None of the jobs I would think about, or very few of them, were even thought of, that are existing today, don't exist. That in 10 years that happens. I look at even my grandkids, and I wasn't even alive when this started. So that this transition into new work environments and new things is so rapid that we have to have very broad and vigorous collaboration among our state agencies in order to get the information out to schools and to students in order for them to make decisions about what they need to prepare themselves. And it may need to be more. We've thought about more as long-term. Increasingly, it may be something we have to think about a little more in the short term because those jobs are changing so rapidly.
And the final recommendation is just an acknowledgement that the work that we're talking about is going to require significant collaboration with a broader community beyond just the education community, and that it's important that as we look at those governance structures and as we look at places where we have, for example, Perkins Consortia already at work, that or Workforce Development Center participation, that those private-public partnerships are enhanced and are brought to bear for the benefit of all of our students.
And Mr. Chair, members, one thing I'd add here, if we're going to have experiential learning in fields that are out there and exist now, we need this collaboration with our industries and our businesses. If we want to get teachers out and have them have experience of what jobs are out there, what's happening, what kind of skills are required, we need to have them, that community involvement. We need to have ways of assuring that if we want kids to go out and have some activities in the workplace or understand what goes on in the workplace, we need to have those situations available to do that. Yesterday, as I was driving into work, there was one of our community college instructors, our presidents on MPR, and I was very proud of what he was explaining, and I think he got the whole concept in this report. Fundamentally, they had totally strengthened their counseling work with their students and spent a lot more time counseling with each of the members, and they found the students found it was beneficial. They'd also tremendously developed outreach in the community, so where they start out with 60 to 100 students having an opportunity to go out and have that experience, they are now over 1,200 opportunities with business and members in the community, whether it's a medical profession or whatever, where they're getting their students out into job-related experiences to enhance their education. So it's taking place. It's taking place in some areas, but we need to ramp this up to take place throughout the state and in all situations.
I agree, Commissioner. I've had similar conversations with both post-secondary and secondary leaders, and I'm really impressed with the philosophical approach that's being translated into real, you know, day-to-day practices of enhanced collaboration in the service of promoting career and tech opportunities for students. I'm particularly attracted, we don't have time to dive deeply at this, but I'm particularly attracted to the concept, to the notion of providing tools that can enhance collaboration. In other words, it's one thing to have a pretty, you know, righteous, you know, Minsky 2-year community college president and a superintendent. I just had this conversation yesterday with the superintendent of Roswell Schools, and immediately afterwards I met with the president of the St. Paul College. You know, that's not a systemic approach. You know, a systemic approach, of course, needs to be driven by good leadership, but we need good tools, and we need good accountability mechanisms that are very transparent and are very engaging of all sorts of folks. And what we haven't said, although it's in here, and I'll stop, is that a key component of all this in terms of the diversity of collaborators are the private sector, small businesses, you know, so that there's a constant alignment with our constantly emerging workforce needs and opportunities here. I'm going to stop, and I'm going to ask Representative Erdahl, who I believe was a member of the task force, and so it would be appropriate to hear from you, Representative Erdahl, and then open it up for some other members. From you, Representative Erdahl, and then open it up for some other members as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and a couple of questions. I don't think you can help me with the first one, which is, why did my phone suddenly start working here? Never did other years, but anyway.
Progress.
Yes. I'm sorry about that. But I'd like to thank both of you for all the time and energy that you put into this. You know, I was pleased to participate to the level that I could with you, and do respect all the work that went into it. I think that what we have brought forth here does provide us some opportunities to move forward into the future, and you know, hopefully address, you know, in a concrete way the guidelines that were established. With that, my question is, you know, for the benefit of this committee, what do you envision in terms of legislation? Will there be a department bill incorporating these, or are you looking at individual bills? What do you think?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this was a legislative task force that was designed and instruction was given to us to help facilitate the work of the task force. Our department process of developing bills, and that started in December. And at this point, because the task force was not done until February, we have not talked about, or, you know, we got the report done last weekend. We have not talked about any specific legislation around this. We offer it to the legislature and the committee, perhaps, and I know Representative Brainerd in particular had suggested that there may be some issues she would want to move forward with. I know you have had a, we had a kind of discussion for the members of the committee about how bold we were being in the task force, and some of the committee wanted to be a little bit bolder than others part of the committee. But I think there are some pieces in here that we would encourage legislators to pick up and maybe see if we can move some of it forward. In particular, the experiential learning, we have some statute 120B.125. Are there ways to, although that passed last session, or the session before, are there ways we can now put a little meat behind some of the things as they're going forward and being implemented? So I think the best bet would be to pick off some pieces and see staff development or teacher training. Are there ways we can pick off some of these pieces and start to work? And in particular, I know districts can maybe proceed with concurrent enrollment or college in the schools. How do we bring all the players together to take on parts and now try to move this forward?
Representative,
well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and you appreciate that. And, you know, whatever suggestions you have to help facilitate that, I think would be good. And to go on the record, I was on the bold side.
That's good. You know, Representative Rubin, I have to say one of my fond memories of last session was where we had arrived at a kind of an awkward point relative to legislation around this that involved several bills, including language that you wanted. And I thought we did a really good job as a group of just sort of kind of calling a timeout and saying, okay, let's do the old-fashioned, get a few folks off in the corner to put some language off. And so you were able to do that, I believe, Representative Brainerd and our staff. And I think that not only reflects well on how we do our work here, but I think also speaks to the importance of this issue to everyone around the table. And so all that by way of sort of setting you up in terms of, you know, I would look forward from a bill from you and Representative Brainerd to keep that that bipartisan, you know, focus and energy on this issue. Representative Isaacson, and then we're going to move on because I just noticed I'm kind of behind my own schedule and we still have the MTLE discussion to have. Representative Isaacson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, I appreciate what we're hearing here. I'm coming at this from the jobs perspective and on the jobs committee. If you think of starting at the schools and working our way up to a career, I've been working on legislation that starts at the career and with companies and with MNSCU and trying to bring it back down to the schools. And so I'm hoping that I've been in the process of researching on my own, and I'm very excited to get your guys' findings as well to be offering a bill that's going to really significantly move forward on the technical piece, technical education, or as we used to call it, vocational education, and seeing us not only provide some policy initiative to bring that back into focus at our K-12, but also funding what's necessary so we don't create an unfunded mandate, so they have the tools they need to re-engage that on a more significant level. So I appreciate the work you're doing, and I look forward to talking to you guys here in the near future as well. Thank you.
Well, Mr. Rosevach, I think is how you pronounce your
Rosevach,
name, right?
Yes.
Yes. It's a pleasure to meet you. Thank you for your work. I want to echo Representative Erickson's words earlier with previous task force. It does require a lot of energy work on top of all the energy and work that you pour into your your work in Irondale, so I just want to acknowledge your leadership on that, and to you as well, Commissioner Hermanson. This was one of many big agendas that we handed you last session.
You aren't losing me yet. I get the help on the
You get to stay up there. Very well. Good. Members, so we'll move on to Part B, if you will, of the agenda today, which is teacher accountability. This is the chair's title. And so we're going to be hearing from the Teacher Licensure Advisory Task Force. And I believe we have Professor Christopher Smith from Augsburg College Education Department. And then Assistant Commissioner Hermanson. And members, I believe there is a report in your packet, so you might want to pull that out. And then before I forget, let me also encourage members to not forget the per diem sheets. They should be in your packet. Please fill those out so that we cover the per diem for attendance today. If you don't find a sheet there, please see Peter or Jamal here, and we'll make sure that that you have that form. So with that, let's move on to hear from Professor Smith. It's good to see you again.
Thank you. Dr. Christopher Smith, education professor at Augsburg College and co-chair of the Teacher Licensure Advisory Task Force. Mr. Chair and committee members, thank you for the opportunity to discuss our recommendation that should be included in your packet. I wanted to discuss some of the rationales behind the decisions that we made, go through the recommendations, and then talk about sort of my own position on the recommendation. There were four main obstacles that I saw in the discussion of the recommendation, and the first of which was just the definition of the objective. What do we mean by basic skills? It was a conversation that we came back to time and time again. In order to assess basic skills, we need to have some sort of consensus, some sort of definition of what it was we were trying to measure. And we never seemed to really be able to arrive at that destination as to what that is. The target audience of the assessment, whether the assessment was written for first year or intended for first year, second year students, students that had graduated and going on in the profession, there didn't seem to be a lot of fidelity of implementation, how the test was meant to be administered and how it was meant to be used. That led to a lot of confusion regarding the instrument as well. The third point being the evidence linking this assessment to teacher effectiveness. As much as we made assumptions that this would measure some sort of future indicator of teacher effectiveness, there never seemed to be any evidence of that ever provided. It seems to be an assumption. It seems to be a fairly safe and obvious assumption, but no evidence really to bear that out. And that would be necessary to support the use of the test. And then finally, does the test provide an unreasonable barrier to entry to the teaching profession for qualified teacher candidates? We heard several stories from teacher candidates, some of which had already gained entry into the teaching profession and had been doing what sounded to be a great job as teachers, but unable to pass the test and were therefore unable to secure a permanent license. These four factors led us to eventually come to our recommendation. The three recommendations being, first one, to repeal the statute requiring so-called basic skills examination. The second, that the Board of Teaching develop a means by which institutes of higher education can provide assurances toward reading, writing, and mathematics proficiency. And the third, to provide an alternative means of demonstrating proficiency for non-graduates of Minnesota board-approved teacher ed programs. I just want to go on the record as saying that I want to make sure we understand this is a repeal of a test, but this is not a repeal of accountability. It's not that the gate becomes wide open. This is the accountability then shifts from the assessment to the IHEs who have worked with the teacher candidates over you know, a period of time. So I just want to make sure that we understand that the accountability is not going away. It's just going to look a little bit differently. Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, just to outline, we did have about three or four meetings in which we did a lot of work looking at the background information behind us. We invited in the testing company. They explained to us how they developed the test. We talked to different people about how the test was taken, what were some of the issues around the test itself, whether it was remediation or access or getting on the computer or whatever. So we thoroughly vetted the information and the problems that were outlined by individuals who did not pass the test, as well as looked at the demographics around those who were passing the test and those who were not passing the test. In that, and I would like to, I'd just like to say for the record, it appears that Pearson developed the test the way we asked them to. This is not necessarily about the company as a company doing what they were contracted to do. What it was about is the value of that test in determining how effective a teacher is going to be. I'd also like to add that in our discussions, nowhere did individuals complain about the pedagogy test, that they all felt that these were necessary and worked because they were teaching or working and they're within their fields, that those tests did not seem problematic. However, we did find that in the term basic skills is a term that's applied to it. I went back and looked at the statute, and I don't see the word basic anywhere in statute. It just calls it a skills examination. And so, as Dr. Smith pointed out, the reference to basic and determining what the skills level should be was a little bit open to interpretation, and thus created some of the uncertainty about what we were looking at. One other thing that was done is we received, and I've received two or three since the report came out, we gathered input from individuals. A lot of individuals wanted to talk to us about this. We had one whole meeting that was devoted to a listening session, and we ended up having to break up into five groups to sit and listen to all the individuals who wanted to talk to us about the skills exam. And we had certain questions we asked, and they told their stories to us. And then we recorded those, and the notes from those listening sessions, I think, can be found online. In addition, we've received many letters, some several pages in length, talking about the difficulty they had in passing or repassing or retaking and the issues around that related to their personal experience. So we got a lot of input. Obviously, we probably didn't hear from the ones who passed it because they did not have the issues. The issue around demographics became concerning because the issue was raised as to whether the test was biased or not. There were some felt it was. Others said that the company indicated that they had thoroughly vetted it through a biased test from their viewpoint and thought that it was not. And so we had a variety of issues to consider, including even the test-taking apparatus itself and how difficult it was for some people to do that. And the colleges shared their viewpoint on how they advise students in the test-taking situation as well. And so there, around that one exam, there were a lot of issues, including the issue of non-native speaking candidates who had been recruited to come and teach in immersion schools from other states or from other countries, and some of the problems they encountered as they tried to master this one exam. And so that is kind of as a background of who we all talked to and gathered input from.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I'd like to add something to something that Rose just mentioned. There were no complaints about the pedagogy exam or the content-specific exams on the whole. So this only addresses the initial battery called basic skills examination.
Thank you. Let me just say a few couple things, because I think that this is an issue that we're going to need to wrestle with in the next, frankly, 3 weeks in terms of a policy conversation. It was the subject of a lot of concern and angst for members from both sides of the aisle. This last session had been an issue, such an issue for a number of years. And we've kind of done changes and adjustments over time relative to this instrument. And so Let me just say, and Dr. Smith, please don't take any umbrage with this, but as the task force recommendation was written, what you see were attempts to kind of include pretty broadly possible approaches, some reflecting the thoughts of individual members that were represented in bills that have been introduced, and others just thoughts that we kind of put our heads together and decided, you know, we need to sort of really cast the net broadly here. Frankly, my hope would have been that the task force would have spent, and I understand why it didn't, but the task force would have spent more time, that's not the right way to say it, the task force would have been more forthcoming with deliberations around things like a use of a portfolio, use of an alternative standardized assessment, et cetera. Not to say that we're the wisest ones here, but those are the kind of things we're interested in hearing more information about. And we put our trust in our Board of Teaching, to do the work well in all sorts of areas. We could have easily have just sent this to the Board of Teaching, just say, hey, do this. So I'm left a little bit, I'm left with some important information here. I think that there is a pretty broad consensus that there's something not quite right with this assessment. I wouldn't go as far as to say that there's agreement that we just dump it. But I think there's concern here, right? And, you know, so we've got 3,000 individuals out there, I'm told, who are most likely pretty competent. They're doing pretty well in the pedagogy and content test, but there's something happening with this test. Still, Dr. Smith, you shared one of the points, and I'm not going to argue it, that no evidence provided support of the use of this basic skills element. I'll take that as fact. What I don't know is whether or not there's been any kind of study done relative to the use of the pedagogy and content tests in terms of its effectiveness. And if there hasn't been, then that argument would lead me to say, well, let's dump the pedagogy and content test as well. And we're not going to do that. There's sort of common sense here, I think, that we're working off of. Not always supported, by, objective empirical evidence, but nonetheless kind of good common sense, we think, as policymakers, and sometimes that's as best as we can do. I am a little loath to just simply kick this over to the Board of Teaching, tying it all up together. I really want us to be able to come up with a much more, a little bit more detailed directive to our Board of Teaching relative to this issue. You're hearing in my voice and my comments my own wrestling with this issue and struggle with it. And please know that, and I think I speak for all of us here, that that's really based on a deep sense of making sure that we're assuring to the public the best professionals that we're placing in front of their children in public education. So let me just stop there. So I kind of got some stuff off, but I think I'm probably reflecting some of the angst that maybe other members have as well, and that predates the task force's work. But there is a dissenting report, and I think it's important that we hear from that as well, and then we'll open it up to a much broader conversation. And so, Representative Erickson, if you would be so kind as to walk us through the minority report from the task force.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and it's not a minority report. It is a dissent report.
Very well.
Unlike other task forces, Representative Yaruso and I were voting members, not ex officio. So that is why I present this along with Senator Sean Nino and two of our non-legislative members of the task force, the Business Partnership and the Chamber of Commerce. And the reason that I was motivated to present this is that we have had such a long track record in Minnesota of providing the highest of quality teachers in our classrooms for our students so they have a bright future. And since 1985, we have had a test in place, or tests, if you want to look at the three components for teacher candidates to take. It is true that they did not necessarily pass that battery of tests before they went into the classroom. Nevertheless, through law changes, we did arrive at that. And so, as you recall, in 2012, Governor Dayton signed a bill that provided for passage of these three tests, which are written by Pearson at a college level. But he signed the bill that provided that our teacher licensure candidates would pass this test before they were placed in the classroom or entered the classroom. And then last year, a change was made. So on behalf of the dissenters, I would recommend that we make or we allow that law that was enacted in 2013, following the law that was enacted in 2012, to play out, because we haven't even given it a chance to work yet. Furthermore, this is an opportunity for us to spend more time, more deliberate time, thinking about what it is we expect of our classroom teachers. And we don't just expect our candidates to go get a job. We expect them to be able to demonstrate and to know themselves, like I do as a teacher, that I am competent in reading, writing, and mathematics. Even if I am teaching kindergarten, mathematics is important because the concepts of mathematics today appear in our standards, our K-12 standards in language arts. They are our K-12 standards in mathematics. The concepts of these higher math skills are in the standards, because remember, Minnesota has the most robust mathematics standards today for our K-12 students. We are not Common Core. We have very robust mathematics standards, and our children are experiencing those beginning in kindergarten. So we want our teacher candidates for licensure to have that same understanding, from my estimation. So my recommendation, and the recommendation of the three others who dissented to the recommendations that came forth from the other members of the task force, is to stay the course. Secondly, we are, as I said, since 1985, using a battery of tests. So we would be backstepping. Saying to the rest of the nation, well, Minnesota has decided that we don't need to do this. Unlike other states who are merging or who are going forth with a higher standard for their teacher licensure candidates, we're backtracking, and to the dismay of many national folks, they're wondering what's Minnesota doing when we have been so highly recognized for our quality in our teachers. And remember, this test is not about an effective teacher in the classroom. This is about a confidence for students, the teacher himself, and parents, our taxpayers, that we have competency in those three areas. Number of candidates passing the test is improving every time. I see that we have the results from through December 2012, but I would like to see the results through December 2013 as well, because I know that's improving. And as Commissioner Hermanson noted, we did hear in a special listening session, although I was not present there, but I did send staff from those who have had problems with this battery of tests. But we never heard in the task force from those who have successfully passed it, and that's thousands, as you know. So we heard one side, and that's skewed in my estimation, and I think in the estimation of the three other dissenters, the presentation that we really grappled with, and believe me, we did grapple. And then one thing that Pearson did, who is the vendor for the MTLE, They listened very carefully to the concerns that were brought forth, not only by those who have had problems with the test, but for the discussion that was going on at the task force. They brought forth recommendations that they would provide to the Board of Teaching to improve the MTLE at no cost. And we never even discussed that presentation that they provided us, which Jamal is now passing out to you. And that disappointed me greatly because it never became a part of the major discussion. So, Mr. Chair and members, that's in a nutshell the report of the dissent. Stay the course. The law presently that is in place requires remediation at the teaching preparation level. So let's let that play itself out. Let our vendor work with the Board of Teaching to make these changes. And, let's give ourselves some more time to think about whether or not we want to eliminate something that is what I would say, so basic, a competency in reading, writing, and mathematics for all teacher licensure candidates. So with that, Mr. Chair, that's my presentation.
Thank you, Representative Erickson. And you and I have been wrestling with this issue for a number of years, so I know that whatever is being brought to the table, we've had several pieces of legislation on this, constantly motivated on making sure that we are doing our due diligence with the public in terms of producing highly qualified, effective teachers. Obviously, we're going to differ on how we best do that, but that's what we're here for, is to have that conversation. I'm going to open this up, Representative Morgan, and then Representative Isaacson and Representative Rudolph. Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Erickson, for your passionate explanation of your dissenting opinion here. I think it really is going to help us have a good conversation moving forward. The nature of these skills tests, and I heard even in your description right there, it was described as a proficiency, a competency, and a basic skills test. And I think trying to get through, I mean, those three words obviously don't all mean the same thing. And trying to figure out what is it we're really trying to establish with that skills test and those levels of performance as it relates to what we need in the classroom, I think will be a good part of this conversation moving ahead. So, but I think this is great. But what I would like to ask the testifiers, Mr. Chair, is what Representative Erickson said about the and what's in the packet here about the Pearson offer to go back at no cost to the state and analyze the tests and make changes to address some of these issues were brought up, and why wasn't it given greater consideration, and why aren't we asking them to do that?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'll answer
Commissioner Hermanson, and I also do want to acknowledge, I've been told that Dr. Smith needs to get back to for a course, I think, and so you've got a time limit?
Mr. Chair, my students have let me know, please be as late as possible. they're okay. They're happy I'm here.
It's good to know that college students have not changed over the years. So, Commissioner Hermanson.
I'm here today because John Bellingham, who was the co-chair and also the chair of the Board of Teaching, wasn't able to be here because of the potential blizzard in his area. And I'll try to answer. The sheet that Representative Erickson handed out was distributed to the committee, and this was, I think, at the second to the last meeting that we had when we received this. Pearson did, and again, I stressed earlier, this is maybe not necessarily about Pearson itself; it's about the concept. But Pearson did come in and visit with us at the department, as well as. And I can't speak for the Board of Teaching because we don't have the department does not have the contract with Pearson. They explained to us what, based on what they were hearing in our task force, what they might be willing to do to answer some of the questions. We had a discussion with them about it, but my direction to them is, since we don't have your contract, you need to go to the Board of Teaching, have this discussion with them, and let us know what you've worked out. I did not, and just it's The executive director of the Board of Teaching left, and this task force was supposed to be operationalized jointly by the MDE and the Board of Teaching. The executive director of the Board of Teaching, who has most of the information, left after the second meeting to take another job. So the board was at a disadvantage during this task force report to have maybe ready access to a lot of information as chair. And so the department kind of ended up having to take over the brunt of the planning and the development of the task force. And we did that as best we could. I am not aware, I don't know, although we encourage Pearson to have this discussion with the Board of Teaching as the testing vendor with the person who has the contract with them. I'm not aware of what that conversation was or what may have resulted if they did have that conversation with leadership at the Board of Teaching. I commend Pearson for recognizing the issues and being willing to come forward with that discussion. And so with the board without any staffing or minimal staffing, it was hard to figure out how to process this information so close to the end of the task force. I think they're sincere in their offers. I think they sincerely want to see if there's ways of resolving some of these issues, but I can't answer as to what the board decided after this offer was made.
If I may. Mr. Chair, one thing I'd like to add to this is not in the letter, but my understanding in talking to Pearson was that their timeline for the implementation of these changes was anywhere from 12 to 24 months, which would run right pretty much through the end of the contract. So while it's a good faith offer, the reasonability of the turnaround time of these amendments may not be entirely feasible.
And Mr. Chair, I would like to just kind of address a little bit the recommendations and how a little bit kind of reflect, and Dr. Smith can jump in. The idea, the question around basic skills obviously was an issue. What does that mean for not only, we heard it repeatedly from the candidates, this was not basic skills, this was college level math, and I'm teaching Phi-Ed, and I mean there was, you know, we heard the comments directly on that. But the recommendations basically are threefold. One was to repeal just that portion of the test. But then second, if you look at the second recommendations, was to direct the Board of Teaching to establish criteria for the College of Preparation where they would have to assure that skill levels, the skills assessments in math and reading have been met either prior to or prior to entrance into the colleges of education or prior to leaving. And that would take rulemaking or adjustment in the process for them. One of the questions that did come forward was why are colleges graduating students that we say are not proficient and whose responsibility? We do know that one college of education did require passage of that test before they'd enter the college preparation program. And then finally, the last recommendation, what would be some possible, you mentioned portfolio, what might be some other options that might be used to demonstrate proficiency in those two skill areas? And the committee did not, they felt that was the purview of the Board of Teaching, did not necessarily feel they should go into describing what a portfolio would look like, because the board does have other portfolio projects that are going forward. And without understanding what their requirements are for those, for us to now superimpose another standard might have been a little bit out of our realm of responsibility. And so the way the recommendations are laid out, it's like a three-step process. Repeal this, require some establishment. Fundamentally, we should be asking people to do their jobs. If you're graduating teacher candidates, or if you have teacher candidates who are not skilled in these levels, why are they graduating? And really, it's putting the onus more back on the colleges and say, do your job, make sure they're meeting the requirement, then give them the certification that they are now prepared to teach and show go get the license. So that was kind of some of the idea behind the three different recommendations. We also have teachers, though, coming from other states and other areas. Right. How do we deal with them when we don't certify, or the Board of Teaching does not set in place the requirements for teacher preparation for those candidates?
Well, if I can observe very quickly, and I'll get to Representative Isaac Senior next here, a couple of quick things here in light of your comments. One is, let's be clear, the task force is not saying get rid of the pedagogy and content tests. Let's be clear about what at least is on the table relative to the task force's report. The thing that continues to perplex me is how someone can do well in the pedagogy and content test and not pass this thing called basic skills that Representative Morgan maybe any number of things. I'm not the psychometrician. I don't know if it's mastery or proficiency or whatever, and that's not a diss on the test. I just don't know. Another thing that you've alluded to, if you will, is that we're wrestling with a particular assessment instrument here. And it's appropriate that we do that because we have chosen in state law to say that, you know, that instrument fulfills an important function for us. But the function is part of a bigger thing for us. And the bigger thing for us really is about making sure that we're preparing, developing, and placing the most effective professionals in each and every classroom across the state. And so I just want us to think about that and kind of keep, not kind of, but really have that constantly in the backdrop here. Because that is the important thing. The important thing isn't getting the perfect test. The important thing isn't, in my mind, having a particular pedagogy or model around an assessment. Those are important decisions. But the most important thing is making sure that we are producing, developing, and assuring to the public that we're placing, you know, the most effective professionals in the classroom. And so this conversation opens up other conversations about what else are we doing in our state on that issue, and what is the crosswalk, the connection between that and this particular assessment. So I'm just kind of really trying to push and shove us all in terms of how we think about this issue, and not just get so, you know, tied into the immediacy as important as that is. Dr. Smith, I do want to get to you, but members, we are going to push on. The chair will keep this going for another 15 minutes because I did say we'd be done at 11:30. And we've got a couple of members who have questions, and perhaps I might offer an opportunity to inject your thoughts on that. Representative Isaacson, and then Representative, we're good till noon? The room? Hey, you know, we might all be hanging out at lunch. So, Representative Isaacson, and then followed by Representative Burdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a couple questions for you. My understanding from your report here is there's 20 members. Is that correct? And 16 of those members signed off on what the recommendations were. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, I can't remember exactly.
The members
who
are listed on page 10
right
here.
Yeah, I have 20 members that I just briefly counted.
I don't recall if every member was available the day we voted, but there were 4 dissenting votes, and the passage rate was 76% by the members.
That's what I was wondering. And then can you tell me, when did you start meeting? What date?
Thursday, August 1st.
And when was your last meeting?
Thursday, January 16th.
And at what meeting was the letter from Pearson presented? Did you say the second to last meeting? Is that correct?
I think it was handed out at the December 5th meeting. I'd have to go back and check.
Okay. I don't find oftentimes that Representative Erickson and I agree as much as I would like. I do believe that she is correct, that we need to have some sort of understanding and making sure that our teachers have the qualities we want in the classroom. I don't think there's any doubts about that. However, I have to share that the preponderance, overwhelming amount of evidence that shows more harm than good that's being done by this test makes it clear that your recommendations are spot on. No questions asked in my mind about that. And I want to be clear that we're framing this discussion in a correct manner, because I'm not sure that I agree with Representative Erickson's approach in how she would frame this. To say that we remove the test does not mean that all of a sudden it's a blank slate. I think somebody up here said that too. To say that removing the test is all of a sudden backstepping, I mean, I think the reality is had we got the test right in the first place, we wouldn't be in this situation. And we clearly did not get the test right in the first place when it comes specific to that basic skill side. And I think that it is our job and responsibility to look at what we see is clearly not working and find a better way to do it. At the same time, I think that I don't disagree that we need to make sure we're still providing for some sort of understanding of making sure our teachers are qualified, right? But did we do that with this basic skills test? I just can't say that we did. And I have to agree that when we're looking at trying to provide some sort of accountability or some sort of assessment that we feel good that what teachers we're putting out there are successful and are prepared to be teachers, right? I don't know that we create a system that, in my mind, seemed to have some punitive aspects to it when you look at the way the test was originally administered and the kind of prep that was originally available. When you look at all these things they're talking about, they expressed that they wanted to do in the second to last meeting, that should have been implemented the first time the test came out. How is it possible that this is now something we're going to do at no cost? Well, of course, you want to keep your contract. And you find there's a large group of people that are unhappy. So in no way am I surprised that all of a sudden they're coming so generously at the last second when they see there's a problem with how people perceive their testing. I can't believe this is still a discussion, and it frustrates me that we're not at a point where we've begun to move on. Do we need to provide some guidance on what that assessment or however we're going to do that looks like? Yes. Does the recommendation start that process? Absolutely. Right. But where we've been, it's just mind-boggling to me after the testimony we heard last year, and then what you've just shared with me, that this is still something we could be possibly wondering if it's still a good idea or not. I think we've conclusively shown no. There is no data. It said, where does it, is it on the first one? I don't have it in front of me here. I think I was the first one we talked about. There's just nothing that shows that these tests are an indication. And so I just can't stress enough that I'm looking forward and to writing the legislation, if I have to do it myself, that's going to change this approach and have a better perspective on solving this issue and providing us the assurances we need that we have teachers that are strong. And so I have to respectfully disagree with Representative Erickson that this is clearly not backstepping. It's taking the right step forward out of a mess we've created. And not only that, it shows that Minnesota is continuing to evolve and innovate and is taking the bull by the horns rather than stepping back or allowing a faulty approach to continue on. So I'm looking forward to seeing this pushed into legislation, and I'm looking forward to seeing it pass, and I'm looking forward to seeing us do a better job with this. Thank you.
Representative Rudolph in Jerusalem. Right? Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just have brief comments. Certainly there are a lot of concerns about testing. I'm going to approach it from a little bit different angle. I'm certainly concerned that roughly one out of four are not passing the test, but I think we need to look at the possibility that maybe everyone shouldn't be taking the test. That we need to do things to raise our qualifications for getting into teacher programs. And I think that would have a consequence of raising the level of our teachers in Minnesota and also finding that more people would pass the test.
Representative Rudolph, may I, with your permission, turn that into a question to Dr. Smith? What about that thought? What about the thought? And that thought actually has certainly been here in this place. I think we have people around the table who have introduced that kind of approach. So tell me your thoughts or anything that if at all, that the task force discussed relative to that thought about, well, why don't we just really focus in terms of, entry into a teacher prep program?
Well, to answer that question, Mr. Chair, and your previous question about why we see these obstacles to the basic skill test, but not the pedagogy or content test. And the answer to that is relatively straightforward. We know what effective pedagogy looks like, and we know what the content expectations are. State and national organizations set that forward. And so we know the target to hit. As a teacher educator, I know what I need to do to put students on that right track. However, for the basic skills test, that objective standard does not exist. It's a target that's moving, if it exists at all. So in the same light, the question was asked, why don't we hear from students that do pass the test? Well, I do hear from students that pass the test. And at no point have I ever had a student say that they were glad that they passed the test or they felt the test was a good measure. Even the ones that do exceptionally well still express a certain amount of shock and surprise as to the content that's on the exams, especially in the mathematics exam. So I do hear from those students. I mean, I do. It's regrettable that we didn't have more of those students into the task force meeting. I think they would have been able to give in some very illustrative information as to that perspective. But I do hear from those students. One other piece to this that I certainly want to address, that the number of candidates passing the test has improved, and this goes to the issue of the 1 out of 4. It's entirely possible that the reason that the number of candidates passing the test is that we are inadvertently weeding out certain demographics from being teachers. And the reason we see the number passing is because we're making the field a little bit more homogenous than it probably should be. This really works. I see in my own department, this is not speculation, we see in our own education department losing teachers of ethnic and cultural diversity because they see this test as an obstacle to becoming a teacher. That works against the diversification of the teacher workforce in Minnesota and the excellent teachers that we should be able to have by this one standard, by this one barrier. So the 1 in 4 that we're passing, this question of maybe everyone should not take the test or pass the test, I don't know who those someones are, and I don't know that's my place to speculate on who those someones should or should not be, or by what standard it is we should begin to measure who is or not suitable for this test. I think that's a very dangerous game to play with our teacher workforce.
So as to pivot from that in terms of an entry framework, same argument, or?
Well, you know, I see a lot of students that come in, and we don't know if they're going to be good teachers or not. I mean, this is a large arc that a lot of students go through. The class that is waiting for me right now are the beginning stages of becoming teachers, and they're just starting to understand what the profession is and what the expectations are. So to try to predict at the beginning, before someone's even began entry into the career, who would or would not be successful, I know there were people that when I began as an undergraduate probably thought, he doesn't have what it takes. I clearly do. So I don't know if that's something that we should begin to become in the practice of doing.
And I'm very empathetic to that because that mirrors, certainly a part of my pathway. Growing up in the 60s and 70s and facing pretty massive low expectations. So I get that. But we have been, I think, moving steadily. We heard it earlier in terms of helping students develop plans, develop those earlys, having those tied to career, goals. We are, I think, moving pretty strongly in a direction of helping younger people have very real-world grounded information about their expectations and what it would take to be able to achieve those expectations. It's an issue, honestly, to struggle with. We're Americans. We don't like this whole notion of tracking, if you will, early. But I think there's some wisdom here about making sure that there's early awareness, early information, so that, heaven forbid if someone spends $40,000, $60,000, to get a private school, college education, or even a public education, thinking that they'll be a teacher at the end, and lo and behold, probably not the best choice. But let me push on. Representative Yaruso and then Representative Deb.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a few comments since I was also on the task force. I also share the bit of the frustration about our lack of opportunity to really go in depth and discuss the various alternatives that might have existed. I think that reflected partly a time limitation because we had a fairly complex task and a lot of time had to be spent up front on presentation of background information. I'm also a bit frustrated with what I think is kind of a disingenuous offer to fix the test at the 11th hour. And that's not so much about the content or the questions that are on the test, but about the transparency of what is on the test, the fairness of the administration of it, and the availability of adequate preparation materials, all of which should have been able to have been done up front. It wasn't a question of development time on that. However, I look back through my notes, and we had at least three meetings in which I noted that someone had asked the question about the existence of proof if there's any correlation between the results of this test or ones like it and teacher effectiveness. And there was never any answer to that. The issue about mathematics preparation for K through 6 teachers is a bit of a red herring because they have to take a mathematics content test. And that content test actually has more math questions than the math test does in the skills test we're talking about. And the list of content for it has a little bit greater specificity in some areas, and so it's easier to tell exactly what's going to be on that test than is on this skills test. So, as I said, that's a bit of a red herring then to focus on the elementary teachers and their mathematics preparation because they are responsible for their mathematics preparation. We do test that already through their content area. What isn't addressed when we focus on that is the relevance for secondary teachers who teach in areas that have nothing to do with that content. For example, English, art, Phi-Ed, tech ed to some extent, although they do need to have a grasp of geometry, world languages, health, and so on. Representative Erickson mentioned the national trends in this, and one of the things that I have noticed is that the pressure to have instruments like this is coming from national groups. It's not coming from our principals. It's not coming from our superintendents. It's not coming from the other teachers. It's not coming from our teacher prep programs. It's coming from national lobby groups. And also, as Representative Erickson noted, she said herself, this test is not about teacher effectiveness in the classroom. That's a direct quote. I wrote it down. So I wish we had had more time to talk about other alternative ways to assess this sort of thing. But I remain unconvinced that the existing requirement that we have is relevant.
Representative Erickson, you're the last, and then I want to do a very quick pivot to the bills that are before us, and try to get us out of here in short order.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representatives, take your time. I'm not saying...
No, I just have a brief comment. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted everyone to know that when the praxis was used, we had almost an identical percentage of failures as we do today. It was maybe 2 to 3, sometimes fewer, but the percentages failing the praxis were comparable for the difficulty. So keep that in mind, that even when we use the praxis, you could look at the charts that I have in my file. I know that I looked at. It was a pretty high rate of failure. So I think that's why the Board of Teaching did what they did in trying to elevate the difficulty to a college level because they saw a need to ensure that if you're going to college, you can read, write, and compute at a college level before you go into the classroom. So just that notation about the praxis.
Members, in one of your packets, what is this, green, blue, greenish packets, we put bills, I had staff look through bills that were related to both of the broad areas before us, student accountability and teacher accountability. One of the thicker packet has a number of bills that speaks directly to the MTLE issue. So it gives you a flavor for the variety of approaches prior to the task force's report that a number of us from both sides of the aisle we're coming up with. And so we have, and I know I'm not pulling these up in the order here, but House File 171 by John Ward, which I think is probably the one that's closest aligned to the task force's recommendation. And this was introduced very early, obviously, in the session in terms of eliminating the, if I'm reading this right, eliminates the BST component of the MTLE and then provides some options for temporary licenses for those who had, but not yet gotten prior past that test. House File 716 by Representative Seltzer creates a exception in relation to non-native English language speakers who instruct in Minnesota other languages other than English. And we, as you recall, we heard testimony from a number of superintendents who run very robust language immersion programs involving a variety of languages that requires them, partly because of the MTLE basic skills challenge, to recruit outside of the state and sometimes outside of the nation. And so there was some thought of wisdom that having those individuals, go through our basic skills test was not necessary relative to the tasks that they carry out. Representative Erickson, you had a bill also introduced very early, House File 34, that looks at a SAT-ACT instrument, and I can't recall if that was meant to be a prior to teacher prep, getting into teacher prep program, or if it was post, but those are variations that, could
Mr.
be
Chair,
on the table.
That was before enrolling.
Very well. And then House File 652, which Keel had, that allows non-native language speakers. So this is similar to Representative Seltzer's bill. I think we might have even had the hearing of both of those bills simultaneously. And then Representative Erdahl, who's just left the room, who also had an SAT-ACT instrument as a possibility. And so, therefore, that's where that language that was sent to the task force about looking at a nationally normed college entrance examination as a possibility, where that came from. And, of course, members, as you all know, last year we passed a on the student accountability side a similar approach, which is replacing the high stakes grad with an SAT-ACT type instrument, a nationally normed college entrance exam. And then Representative Erickson, you also had another bill, House File 1166, which looks like it involves this issue of doing 3-year temporary licensures. And I suspect that, consistent with your testimony today, that, the argument there is, give this thing some time, and it'll play itself out. So lots of different approaches on the table, Commissioner Hermanson.
Yeah, I want to refer you to page 3 of the report, too. I want to just make one point based on the last couple of things. By the way, I do have the demographics data. When the committee looked at the demographics, they looked at July 1, 2013. We had a handout as to who was passing and not passing the 3 different tests. And I'm sure this has been updated by now. So, and it was there was a higher percentage of non-white candidates not passing for in all 3 categories, and we can share that with you. But I do want to stress one thing, that many of these teachers who are not passing are teaching. They're basically in the classroom under other temporary licenses, limited licenses, community experts. And what we kind of heard from some of these teachers, especially the non-natives, they work the system. They go from one immersion school, they'll get their temporary licenses for 2 or 3 years, and then they move over to another school or their district helps them work a little bit the system because they can't, they've repeatedly taken these tests and not passing them. And it was their frustration of the cost involved. Some of them are here working on like visas, and in order to get a visa, they have to show employment. There were a lot of non-related costs involved for some of these candidates who had been recruited. One individual teacher had taught in two other states and had been fully licensed, came to Minnesota, been recruited to come into a language immersion school, and had taken a test three or four times, hadn't passed it, and was just going to move from one language immersion school to another. So we've created kind of a quagmire here a little bit, too. And that particular teacher had also taught in two other countries. And so, you know, having some flexibility in how, and we are licensing them, but under the school board coming to us asking us for a waiver or whatever thing, but it's kind of has created some unintended consequences for both the candidates and for the district.
And Representative Erickson, I apologize. I did say earlier, of course, the room is empty, but that if there were members here who had bills, that they can speak to them. And so I want to offer you an opportunity to talk about any of those bills that you've offered in the past. Anything you'd like to share at this point, and we'll try to wrap up here pretty soon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment about what Commissioner Hermanson was just saying. Although we heard from those in immersion programs who had difficulties or frustration with the MTLE, we never really addressed what we should do about those or out-of-staters. When the vote was taken, I felt that it was inconclusive about the direction we were actually taken according to the charge that was given us. And I just say that because that has bothered me ever since the task force adjourned, that we really did not consider the immersion teachers or candidates or those who were coming to us from out of state. I only have one comment about a bill that was in the packet, and that's House File 1351. And I wanted to ask the department to comment on what is not happening. Typically, we have a SLED report annually, that's in law, about what's happening with remediation at the college level. And I was wondering if I could indulge you to ask the department to come down and tell us what's happening with longitudinal data, whether it's the SLEDs, which I know in the higher ed bill we did make a change last year. And some of that is part of what was my 1351. But the other is the other longitudinal data system that's at the department and whether or not that's playing out. Because recently, in visiting with one of our vendors here in Minnesota, data quality campaign, I received this kind of chart which demonstrates for you how important data is to teachers and to the success of our students. And so I'd like to hear from the department on both those longitudinal data sides. Thank you.
Mr. Corte.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, which bill was it, which bill number was it that you mentioned?
House File 1351.
I'm sorry, what number?
House File 1351, authored by Representative Erickson.
And Mr. Chair and Mr. Corte, that was expanding the longitudinal data system, not only through P20, which I think was done in part in the higher ed bill of this session law 2013, 127.870, but also, you know, to update us on what's happening at the department in regard to the longitudinal data, because Commissioner Montano told me that she would send me an update, but if you could just share with the committee what's happening. And why aren't we getting a SLEDS report? That's an annual request so that we know how many of our students going off to college are needing remediation. That's an important, pretty important question for us to consider.
Sure. Mr. Chair and Representative Erickson, I think there's a couple of different things that that I'll address in there. The first one is you're right, at the joint hearing the other day, we did promise you that we'd have a report on SLEDS, and I know that we have some staff that are working on that. I apologize we haven't gotten it to you yet, but but I will get that to you as well as to the entire committee. So that is in the works. Regarding the post-secondary remediation report, we've heard a lot about that report as well. I don't have the statute number in front of me, but there's a statute that requires public post-secondary institutions to submit to the department summary data on the number of students that they have coming into their systems that require post-secondary remediation, and then the department is to report that to the legislature. In the past few years, the way that has worked, I think that statute was developed before the existence of the MNSCU system and kind of the Office of Higher Education as it's set up now. The way that it's worked in the past is that MNSCU and the Office of Higher Education have put out that report. It's commonly referred to as the Getting Prepared report. I do understand that they didn't put one out last year, but I've heard Chancellor Rosenstone speak publicly that they will be working, and Commissioner Bogemiller, to put that report out soon. It's just kind of the way the statute's written. We're just the ones delivering the report. We don't hold the data, not to pass the buck that we're not working to get it done, because we are. But I've been told that should be coming very soon.
Very well. Members, thank you for allowing me to run us over our time. We bit off some really big chunks here, and clearly we needed to spend some more time on a number of these, particularly on this last issue, but we'll have some time in the coming weeks to do that. So in the meantime, enjoy your last few days of freedom, and we'll see you all next week. This committee stands adjourned.
Yeah. Making sure that.